Good day and welcome to The View From Here on KGVM 95.9 FM Gallatin Valley Community Radio. Along with Jeff Milchen, I'm Steve Kirkhoff, and today we welcome Crystal Chvilcek to the KGVM studio for a conversation about her work with Family Promise, a nonprofit organization dedicated to offering a variety of services designed to help homeless families find and keep both secure housing and gainful employment. Crystal is a Bozeman native, an MSU graduate, a mother of two, and the executive director of Family Promise of Gallatin Valley. Welcome, Crystal.
Thank you.
Well, Crystal, you are a native of Bozeman and a graduate of MSU, where you received your bachelor's degree in marketing. Is that right?
Business management.
Sorry, business management. So, and then later you attended online Walden University and earned a master's of nonprofit management there. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, how did you come to this decision to make the nonprofit work your life's endeavor? I mean, how did you know that work in the nonprofit industry was your calling? Was there like an aha moment, an experience that set your mind running in this direction? A mentor maybe whose footsteps you wanted to follow? Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I randomly took a job at a nonprofit, you know, over 14 years ago. You know, I saw it in the advertisement and I said, I've got the skill sets, let's try this out. It was when I sat down in the chair, I realized what I was actually applying for. But I was so excited to try something new. I'd been working, you know, in just the business world and not enjoying it every day. And I would say probably within 2 or 3 months, I was hooked. I think one of the reasons I really got connected to the work was I'm born and raised in Gallatin Valley. And, you know, I remember when there was one dirt road in to come into Bozeman. And even, you know, 13 years ago, we were starting to get really big and booming. And I realized that we needed to keep this community open for all. And I didn't want people, even like I include my family in that, being either priced out or moving on because they couldn't make this their home anymore. And I thought of everybody else and I said, man, social service work is great, so I can keep everyone here happy and working towards what they want to, you know, do in life.
So it sounds like you took a look around the landscape in a way, both the landscape of what was happening physically to the ground and the new housing starts and the growth and also mm-hmm. the people.
Yeah.
The people who were coming and the people who were going.
Yeah, definitely.
So it sort of evolved for you.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't something that you knew when you were like a kindergarten. You weren't like drawing pictures and showing your teacher, I want to do this one day.
A little bit. If you know, if I look back as me as a kid, like I was always in the resource room working, you know, working with the kids that had, you know, disabilities. I was always trying to do extracurricular activities. And it's so funny, about 2 summers ago, my mom came and she said, hey, I'm going to get everything that you own in my house and throw it on the lawn, and you need to come look at it. And if you don't want it, I'm throwing it in the garbage. And so I came out that day, I was going through the lawn, and I found some of my writings, and I think it was from my second grade writing, and I said I was going to be an Olympic swimmer, and if that didn't pan out,
I
was going to help people. So I guess deep down, if you think about it, it's always kind of played in the back of my brain, but it didn't really hit home until I read that letter, and I thought, wow, here I am. So many years later, doing exactly what I said I was going to do.
I know, and isn't that interesting that even in your fantasies of what year were you? I was second grade, you said?
Yeah.
It seems like there was this division between what was excellence,
yeah.
right? Like being an Olympian,
yeah.
versus what was like really a thing that struck your heart as important to do.
Yeah.
But do you still feel that way?
I do. Well, I obviously can't swim. I still plug my nose.
No, I don't mean about the Olympian.
I know. I say I force that on my kids because they're both swimmers. But I do. I think it's what's great about the work we do is I go in every day knowing that I'm making a difference and that it's not just a difference for the families we're working on. It's the difference with the community, whether you're thinking of you're connecting volunteers to causes that are important to them or advocating for something that's important for the community so it can get better and bigger, you know.
Right.
I think it's just great. It makes me smile.
Absolutely. And I guess what I'm driving at is that maybe even this notion that working in the nonprofit industry is a form of human excellence, maybe that's something that could be more commonly espoused.
Yeah,
right?
I like
and,
that.
And circulating
yeah.
in our milieu, like just in the environment in which we live.
Yeah, and I feel like, too, like I never was solely happy with what I was doing in life until I found this work, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like I was always just getting up, doing my thing, and not really striving to be great because mm-hmm. I just didn't like it.
You were punching the clock in a way.
Yeah, and now it's like, how can I be better? What can I learn? How can I, you know, keep mm-hmm. succeeding? Because ultimately what I'm doing is bettering people.
All right. So give us a sense of what the scope of work that Family Promise does is and how you're improving people's lives. How do people come to you?
Yeah.
You know, what's kind of the background of some of your clients, just to give listeners a kind of a big picture view of your work.
Yeah, definitely. So I've always kind of worked in the education realm or with families experiencing homelessness and kind of all of my jobs in the nonprofit world. But with Family Promise, that's exactly what we do. And we kind of look at it in three facets, whether it's prevention. So how do we prevent families from getting evicted or whatever that, you know, that looks like. Our shelter program. So it's families that have already lost their housing. And so we get them into the shelter program. And then the other piece is stabilization. So how do we ensure that these families don't end up homeless again? And so what I always try to convey to people is it's not a one size fits all for everybody. It's we really look at each family holistically, and we know that housing isn't just finding a place to live. It is financing, it is mental health, it is childcare, it's transportation, it's all these little things. And you can't just say, well, this person, we're going to do these three things, and then we're going to do the same thing for that family. And so every family that comes to us is unique and different, and we build this family success plan based on what they need to do to get into that house.
Well, you started off with the idea of preventing eviction. I was curious, since I haven't heard the latest at the federal level, there's been, you know, some protections in place to prevent mass evictions, mm-hmm. but last I knew, those were set to expire as of January. Can you fill us in on the state of that?
Yeah, so that's all I've heard too. With the new CARES funding and act that was just put into place, I think it was yesterday,
right.
They're saying still till the end of January, which is going to cause a big mess, you know what I mean? Because, you know, if you think about it, obviously landlords need to get paid so they can continue in business, but then you're talking about, I don't know how many people that are going to be behind on rent and losing their housing, and then you're coming up against a zero rental vacancy here. You know what I mean? There's mm-hmm. a zero vacancy here in the Valley, and mm-hmm. so it's going to be really interesting what happens.
Just to follow up on the new CARES re-upping, are there provisions in it, to your knowledge, that would support landlords, that do support employers by subsidizing payrolls or by helping landlords to gather what they need to on a monthly basis so that they don't have to talk eviction or they don't have to talk firing employees?
You know, I don't know if I can speak specifically on that, but I know that, you know, even ourselves as a nonprofit, we applied for some federal funding or relief to help us as an organization. I know that was open to everybody, but I don't know specifically if there's anything for them. So, sorry, I guess I can't answer that.
The initial reports I heard didn't contain any.
I don't think they do.
Thing new on that front, but the interview today is taking place on the day probably will just be signed into law, and it's about 5,000 pages, so you're forgiven for not being able to answer detailed questions.
That's okay.
Maybe we can jump back just a couple of paces
and
go to the roots of Family Promise.
Yeah.
And you might want to talk about that because I believe it's a national organization, right, with a local chapter, more or less.
Correct.
And
yeah.
So if you could just tell us what is the mission and then, again, hit on those services.
Yeah.
And then maybe later we can talk about how you measure success.
Definitely. You're correct. So Family Promise is all over the world. We kind of pay a dues to be a part of this organization, but those dues are really important because we are provided technical assistance. We're provided, you know, opportunities for funding. Like we received just, I think it was 6 months ago, you know, $10,000 from the head of Family Promise National to do prevention work. Yeah, so it's what I appreciate, though, about it is I did work at the YMCA, and it was kind of like a one-size-fits-all for all the communities. But with Family Promises, you look at it's considered a community-based response to family homelessness. And so they really view that every community is different, and you can't do that one-size-fits-all. And so they basically say, address family homelessness in your area, and we really don't care how you do it.
Okay. So if I could just jump in there.
Yeah.
So it's community-based, even though it's a national organization.
Mm-hmm.
You say that they give deference to local groups to sort of tailor their services to what the needs are on the ground in the particular locations.
Yep.
And so talking a bit about Bozeman and the Gallatin Valley, what are those particular characteristics that you're trying to deal with head-on?
Yeah, so a couple big ones is obviously our housing, I call it a housing crisis. You know, you're looking, what was it, 2 months ago, they were saying that the average medium home price was a little over $500,000. And just a couple months later, it's almost $700,000. So just to see that drastic of an increase in housing, you know, which affects our rental market, right? And so I think what we're looking at is the high prices. We also are looking at there's no vacancies for rentals. And then you're also looking at, you know, minimum wage jobs. And, you know, the standard is you should really only spend 30% of your income on housing. So when you think of, you know, some of these jobs are only paying $15 an hour. And if you do that math, you know, rental right now is anywhere between $16,000 and $2,000 a year. So that's just, I mean, a month, sorry.
$1,600 a month for a single.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. That would be, I think, a two-bedroom is what we're looking at right now. It's about a $1,600, $1,100 for a one-bedroom. But we're talking, we work with families. And so so you got high rent, low-paying jobs, no availability for housing, basically. And then the other thing we're seeing, which is pretty recent, we have some low-income housing opportunities here, but a few of them just got bought up by private private firms. So there's that fear that those aren't even going to be low-income anymore.
Are these the tax credit housing that were built by, say, Dab Dabney and Company back in the day?
I don't know if he's this specific developer, but yeah, there's been some of those low, exactly.
Right.
The same kind of tax credit, but now they're being bought up by private entities.
Yeah. And those typically stay in the low income bracket for a period of years, and then they can flip into the private, right?
Correct, yeah. Right. And so we're seeing that too. So we already started with a really low market of low income or affordable housing, and now we're even going to be lower because people are coming in and buying them. And so, I mean, that's a lot of factors. And so when you think of the families that we work with, I like to say that a lot of these families may have made some choices 10, 12 years ago that they're still being held to with housing. And so maybe they, you know, I talk about, you know, I was a kid, I made dumb mistakes, you know, everybody kind of does when you grow up. And some of those things are still affecting families to the point that they can't get housing. And so we have to stop this generational poverty, because if we don't stop it now, it's just going to keep happening. And so we need to give these families a chance and an opportunity.
So it sounds daunting, because the market is the market, and it's difficult to contain unless you have a governmental entity or a nonprofit agency that actually owns land and can control one of the price variables in driving up housing. It's very difficult for an organization like you. You're trying to help individual families to get back on their feet again, to get a solid basis in the community, but you can't control all of those sort of macroeconomic factors.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, do you do any policy work? Do you do any encouraging of local governments, whether it's the county commission or the city commission, to find ways to lock up land or to create trusts that might establish locations and housing that could be in perpetuity low-cost housing?
You know, so I've been at Family Promise for about 13 months, so I just celebrated my one-year anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that we need to do better at. You know, there's a new affordable housing coalition that's going to be put on by the city of Bozeman, and I'm going to participate in that. And so I think it's a great opportunity for us to try to make a little bit of that impact. However, we haven't really in the past necessarily. I will say that we are currently working on a project. I don't know if you've seen it or heard about it, but it's behind Lowe's, and there's going to be some affordable housing built by a company called GMD, and it's a multi-structured ownership property where HRDC is going to be kind of the owner of the housing after it's done. It's a tax credit purpose, and then we are actually going to be building a new building on one part of the land, and CHP is going to be building on another portion of that land. And it's kind of funny, right? We're not dealing with the housing, but in order to make the housing happen, we need to build on that land. Does that make sense? So that's kind of our key part of trying to get some more affordable using units here, is by working with them to build a new day center, which will help us, you know, working with families during the day. And then we're also on the first floor as a childcare center, because childcare is a huge issue.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is a partnership with HRDC.
In a way, and GMD, the developer. Yeah, they're a private developer out of Seattle that is actually what they call the main owner in this project, and then HRDC is a part, and us and CHP.
Can I ask who sought whom in that particular arrangement?
Yeah. So we were very lucky, you know, as any nonprofit, we are ran by a board of directors. And we have one of our board members sits on the GHAC committee at the city level. And
what's that?
Oh, I'm trying to remember the Galton Homeless Action Committee. I'm probably saying that wrong. I might have to look that one up. I just always call it GHAC. But he sits on that committee, and he'd heard about this project and how they needed partners. And so we kind of slipped in that way. And so it's been a good opportunity.
So that was opportunism in a way.
Right? We were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Wonderful. So we've talked a little bit about how difficult it is in the market that we face to make things happen. So I'm curious to know, how do you take your mission statement and then work with a family and then decide, How has this been a successful interaction that we had with this family or not? How do you measure that, and working in such a tough environment?
Yeah, so we have a couple different things. So when a family first comes to us, we call it our self-sufficiency matrix. And so we look at over 15 different areas of strength, you know, areas that we could work on. And it's housing, childcare, financials, you know, all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we score them at the beginning. And that kind of allows us to set our path forward of the major goals that we need to work on immediately, and maybe some longer term goals. And then we track our success kind of based on that self-assessment during their period and their stay with us. And that's what drives that individual family success plan is, you know, so we do the self-assessment. We're like, okay, in order to get you into housing, your four areas of need are this. Mm-hmm. And then we work with them on that. And then we can kind of score ourselves as we go by. Mm-hmm. Another thing too, is just looking at the data. Typically, in the past years, our shelter program was a 90-day program, so we could move families into housing in about 90 days. In the last year, that's actually pushed more to over 120 days, and so you're just even seeing families in our shelter capacity longer. And so, you know, we kind of have those matrices looking at it. But really, when you're in this type of housing market, it's really all about the relationships. And so, you know, we are very fortunate. We have a huge database of volunteers and supporters, and we sometimes just have to make a call for support and say, does anybody have a rental and is willing to take a chance on this family? And sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, we're also trying to work with landlords and building that partnership about, before you evict a family, please come talk to us. You know, let's see what we can do to mm-hmm. keep them in this current house. Mm-hmm. And so I really go back to this type of market. It's got to be those relationships and those partnerships and mm-hmm. people trusting that you're doing what you need to do.
So what is it when you're working at your hardest and you're doing your best and things are going as well as they can? What is your capacity, would you say? Like, how many families can you actually get out of these dire straits into more solid footing?
So with COVID this year, we did this let's say yes model as much as possible, because we knew that with COVID things were even going to get harder. And so before I got here, we just really focused on shelter, and we could do 3 to 4 families every 90 days. We were able to get funding for prevention, which has been a huge help with this COVID stuff. And then we also have 7 transitional housing units, and we call those transitional because sometimes you just need more time to find housing. And so they can stay in those units for up to a year. They pay $350 a month for rent starting out, and then every 6 months it increases. So you can work with a family on budgeting in a higher cost. And then everything over that $350, if they do their case management plan and they're successful, they get it as an extra savings account to move on to their next housing. And so, you know, so if you consider that kind of piece, typically in a year we'd serve about 24 families. But this year we are on target to serve about 105.
Wow. Yes. How is that possible given what we just talked about? It sounds like it should be going the other way.
I think it's really because of the prevention work that you're talking about, you know, like keeping them in the house instead of, because, you know, our shelter capacity in the past was the 3 to 4 families. We were very lucky. St. James Episcopal Church donated a building to us, and so we were able to now have 2 shelter site locations. So that's brand new this year. Once again, it's our donors and our partners making it able to happen. But I like to say it's been a busy year. and that we've been fortunate enough that we can keep up and have the support, you know, because a lot of time you have to say no because you don't have the funding or you don't have the building space or whatever that looks like. And I will say, even though we've opened a second location for our shelter, we still have 9 families on a waiting list. So, I mean, we could open another shelter if we had the resources and, you know what I mean, with it, you know, to get more families in.
So I'm curious, Crystal, have you seen a rise in demand this year relating to COVID, or is it more just you're feeling that you've got to step up and do more that's driving the increase?
I think both. Okay. I felt like in my mindset, I'm a go-getter, and I always want to challenge our staff and our team and everybody, like, okay, how much more can we do? Like, how mm-hmm. much bigger of a difference can we make? So I think there's that piece of it, but also there's the piece that our community is growing. More people are coming here thinking they can afford it without doing their research, and then the reality hits. And so I think there's a couple different factors in there that have caused the high increase.
Have you noticed that in the families that you're working with, is that more of them as a percentage of the whole are new to the community?
It's so funny. I was trying to do the math on this, and I think I would say it's about 50-50. So about, you know, 50% of the increase would be from new families moving in. And then the other portion is just that they're getting priced out, or they just can't make it anymore, and they want to stay here, and they've lived here their whole lives. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned a bit ago something about partners. The Episcopal Church, and I know the Family Promise does not work alone. Can you tell us a little bit about the partnerships that you have and how they are so crucial to your success?
Yeah, so Family Promise started in Bozeman, 15 years ago, I think it is, and we started on what they call a rotational shelter model, which meant that every week our families went to a new church, which meant there was a new group of volunteers that took care of those families for a week, which would help with the food and, you know, activities at night for the kids and washing bedding and all that kind of stuff. And so we have all these amazing church partners throughout the valley that do that for us. When COVID hit, we actually went to a static site model, which meant that our families weren't going church to church because of the risk of, you know, spreading the illness. And also a lot of our volunteers are elderly. And so we converted our day center where our offices were into a shelter location. And then St. James gave us this other location for another site. And so now the church is kind of still take care of the families, but from a distance. So they drop foods off at the door and those kinds of things. And so really, we call it a host week. So each church has a host week that they're responsible for.
So families are not actually residing in churches anymore.
Nope. And it's interesting that this happened with COVID, right? Because there's a lot of Family Promises. You know, I talked about being a national organization earlier. A lot of people are starting this model because of the trauma that it causes children, right? So think that you're a family that's... Think that you're a child, right? And you've already lost your home. You could potentially have lost your dog because, you know, when you're homeless, that kind of stuff happens. And then you go to Family Promise and you have this hope that you have a house over your head, but then you have to move every week, right? And so it just adds to that trauma. And so we are actually looking, even after COVID moves, hopefully soon, that we will still stay in this model because it's better for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited. So like I said, like COVID pushed us into this method, but we've seen such a positive outcome from it. And we've actually surveyed all of our church partners, and a lot of them feel the same way. And so it looks like this might be something that we do for the rest of our
lives.
And
you said that you had 7 properties where families can stay for up to a year.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
But that you also helped more than 100 families. So obviously, physical housing is just one small piece of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you just shine a light a little bit more on some of those other services? Because you helped more than 100 families, but only 7 of them were in physical housing.
Yep, right? Exactly. And then we have the families that are in the shelter. And so that's, you know, as soon as they find housing, they're out. And so, like I said, that's about 120 days is what we're looking at right now. And that's 7 families at a time in those shelter locations. And then the other piece is that prevention work, or what we call, we also have a new program called Help Us Move In. Sometimes one of the last things you need to move into a house is that extra income. So that first and last month's, you know, deposit. Right. And that is exactly what that program does, is just provide up to a certain amount of money for that move-in cost. Mm-hmm. And so you know, Family Promise has always really been focused on shelter, but the more and more we dive into the prevention and the Help Us Move In, it's so much cheaper to keep a family in their home rather than into the shelter and then trying to find housing and that continual cycle. And so if we can stop it from happening or get move them right into a house rather than the shelter, it's so much better.
So does prevention involve a fair amount of financial assistance?
It does. So we provide up to $1,200 per family, and it's kind of depending on their housing unit and then the size of their family.
$1,200 per
person. Yep.
Per person.
Per family.
What length of time?
So one time is what our hope is, because we're hoping that we can prevent it. And then that actually comes with case management. So, you can't just fix the problem with a financial check. So the families have to agree to work with us. And so the same thing, we do that self-assessment. We look at it, what can we work on to ensure that we're not having to cut another prevention check.
Yes, and the prevention checks go to families where there might be gainful employment or not? Or how does employment figure in there?
So we want them to have, so there's a couple things we want. We want employment, that the actual $1,200 will make a difference in, you know, actually getting them into their house or whatever. It's almost like that last piece. And then we're really important. We think school's obviously so important. And so all the kids have to be enrolled in school, believe it or not. Sometimes that doesn't happen. So we kind of just look at those three things. And then we don't give the check to the family. We give it to the landlord. And then we work with them. The minimum is 3 months, but sometimes families want to work longer because they're seeing that success and they're seeing what they should be working on.
Are there eligibility requirements when a family shows up? You do an interview and find out whether it's going to work or not?
Yeah, so we really, another thing we've worked on this year is being a lower barrier shelter or program. And so we really only do two things that we have to say no to. Actually three, is if you have a sexual offense on your record, we can't take you. If you have an active substance abuse, we can't take you until we've seen that you've been sober for 3 months. And then the final one is a violent offense. But other than that, we are trying our best to accept everybody. And the reason we have those three lower, you know, things that we look at is because we deal with so many volunteers. And it's also, if you are in the shelter program, it's that co-housing. And so we want to make sure everybody's safe.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, speaking of volunteers, what are some of the things that people in the community can do to get involved in Family Promise?
On
that basis.
So we say we have so many projects. We have people that come and do our yard work, paint walls, they unclog toilets, all sorts of different things, because those are just extra expenses that we don't want to have. And so when you think of all these, you know, the volunteer base started with these church partners, you know, and every church, you know, if they start getting solicited to help with their hosting week for Family Promise. And we have over 700 people that we reach out to when we need assistance or help with things. And so it's been great.
Mentioned the website for anyone who's interested in getting involved while we're on the topic.
Yeah, it's FamilyPromiseGV, so for GallatinValley.org.
All right.
Yeah.
And so how many Family Promise groups are there around the country, or does it go beyond the United States?
No, it's countrywide, or, you know, United States-wise. I don't know the number off time. I know there's over 200.
Okay.
Here in Montana, we have six.
So I guess what I'm curious about is how, and maybe we've already covered this, I'm not sure, because you've gone through a lot. you have a tremendous knowledge at your fingertips. But success.
Yeah.
So you have this intake moment where you bring the family in and they seem to be right. They seem to be a promising group to work with. And then after a certain amount of time, you might part ways. And then when you look back on that interaction that you had with that family, how do you say that was a success or that one didn't quite work? What's the difference there between those two experiences?
Yeah, so I always go back to the children, right? We're doing this for the children, you know, it's like I always go back to. And sometimes we have to make some of those difficult conversations, you know, those difficult decisions of, is this the best option for the children? You know what I mean? And so I always go back to, were the children safe? Were they happy? Were they thriving? And I think that's really the success of what I look for.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously the families, you know, you want to look at the whole family unit, but our number one thing is the children and how do we keep them? Because we want to stop that generational poverty and teach them that there's something different and this is how we get ahead and things like that.
I looked at the website and you had a very ambitious statement in there. I'm not sure if it was the mission, but I think the ultimate goal is to end family homelessness in Gallatin County.
Yeah, we say one family at a time. It's how we say it. So it is a big one, but really it is one family at a time, you know, and looking at every family different and what they need and just going from there. And it's a piecemeal process sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, but I this is a new story and I'd love to share it. I stopped by our shelter location the other day and there was this new little girl that was walking around. She's like 9 months old. And she was hanging out with one of the other family members of a different family and she was 11. And the 11-year-old just hit it home for me. I go, oh my gosh, I can't believe she's walking. She's only 9 months old. And the 11-year-old goes, well, wouldn't you learn to walk when you finally feel safe? And wow. I took a moment and I said, can you, because I just want to understand her concept. And I said, can you tell me more? Like, why does she feel safe? And she goes, well, she slept in a car for 3 months with no back window. And now she has a whole house to run in.
Wow.
And I couldn't, like, I don't know how many times I tried to explain what we do, but hearing it from an 11-year-old and her being in the shelter talking about another little girl that was there in that capacity.
That's
just
profound.
Really hit it home.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
All right. Just want to remind listeners, you're listening to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio.
We're here this afternoon and this talking with Crystal Chvilacek, the Executive Director of Family Promise. Crystal, a moment ago, you gave a very poignant story of an 11-year-old sister talking about her younger siblings' happiness at having some security and some safety and how you take that as a measurement of your success. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wonderful and that's beautiful and I applaud you. I think your work is inspirational. It's totally needed in this county and just great to have you here.
Thank you.
If you could have a magic wand and sort of make things happen in this valley so that the need for your services would decrease because people were doing better, because there wasn't housing insecurity, because jobs were stronger and more reliable. Is there a place where you would start? Have you thought about, like, if I could just change a variable or two of the way that life works in Gallatin County, I would ...
Oh, that's a good one. I feel like there's so many little things, but I would go back to if we could just get some more affordable housing units. You know what I mean? Because obviously this is a place that everyone wants to be. We live in a beautiful community. People are coming from all over and they can afford it, right? But we have to really remember the people that live here or the people that are coming here for a fresh start. And I think it's just a reality check to those people that come here because they're so used to having more options in these bigger cities and these bigger areas. And so if we're growing as big as we are, then we need to keep up with that demand and figure out a way to get some more affordable housing units here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So any thoughts on the policy changes needed to accomplish that? Because obviously that's quite a challenge when, as you mentioned, there are so many people where it's nothing for them to drop $1 million on a home in Bozeman. What policy changes would you, and I realize you may have some you advocate personally that you can't say represent Family Promise, but what do you think personally are some of the things that need to happen here?
You know, one of the big things is the availability of land at like an affordable opportunity. You know, so we've been working on this deal with HRDC and CHP and all of that, and it comes down to being able to have that land piece because there is a lot of, I think, opportunity to bring in some more tax credit things and apartment complexes and stuff like that, but it really goes down to the land piece and how expensive it is to get a piece of land to build that size of a unit that you need.
Let's just stop right there if you don't mind me talking over you.
Yeah.
So here we are. Instead of being in the basement of this ancient tiny structure on Mendenhall, we're actually just down the road a piece at the Gallatin County Commission. And we're advocating before the Gallatin County Commissioners so that they can find a way to help us control spiraling land costs. Mm-hmm. And what might we say?
You know, I don't think we've had those conversations quite yet, but one thing that I've tossed in my brain is more you know, and maybe, I don't know, maybe I'll get booze for this comment. So I'll say this is a personal, maybe, opinion. But there has been conversation about people moving here and maybe adding some sort of tax to that person or, so, you know, like a move. I don't know what you'd call it necessarily, but that would kind of be put aside for families for this kind of need, you know, for affordable housing. Because I don't think when people move here, they really understand the problem that's occurring. Does that make sense?
It does indeed make sense.
They want to come here to go hiking and skiing, and it's a beautiful community and all that kind of stuff, and they don't really have it in the back of their brain that
so,
this is a problem.
You say the word tax, which of course makes certain people cringe.
Yeah.
Certain 100 million or so.
So I said my personal opinion, maybe.
You know, it's consider it a payment into community health.
Yeah.
Right? Along with, you know, what you pay to license your vehicle or any other number of payments that we make for community health into community systems of police and security, of roads, of water, of wastewater, etc. So there are numerous ways of doing that. Real estate transfer taxes, for example, taxes on second, third, fourth homes, for example. So these things are out there. And let's just stay with this for a second.
Okay.
Let's not even consider the Montana legislature, which could at any moment invalidate local government's autonomy and control over such variables. But let's just imagine for a second that the Gallatin County Commission could do that. That would be something that could help, you would think, right?
Yeah.
Those who are able are contributing to a kitty to enable those who are able but less fortunate in terms of their income.
Definitely. And I even think about, right, so I think it's McDonald's right now is between $13 and $15 an hour. So I even worry about these continuing driving costs of housing. We're going to lose service workers. You know what I mean? And then we're not going to be able to go out and have a meal at a restaurant because we don't have wait staff because they can't afford to live here. So even looking at bringing in some housing for lower income employees, you know, to keep our economy alive and people, you know, being able to come out here and do things. And it's a big issue.
It is a big issue.
Crystal, in terms of the housing that you all work on placing people in other than your own, first off, is all the property that your organization has directly in Bozeman? And then is any of the property that where you're placing people further afield than Bozeman and the immediate surroundings?
Yeah, so the property that we own is in Bozeman and Belgrade.
Okay.
And we do place people in Gallatin Valley. The sad part that I'll say that we're coming to really in these conversations now with families is, can you make a living here? And almost kind of encouraging them to look elsewhere. And that doesn't feel good because you want this to be a community for all. But sometimes that is the reality of the situation when someone's been in your shelter for, you know, 6 months and they're not getting anywhere and we're not getting any success. Right. It's almost, what other community can we look at, unfortunately.
So what are, I don't know if there is a really a typical profile of your clients, but can you give us a sense of what some of the typical backgrounds are, the ages, you know, demographics of the people you serve, just to give listeners kind of a clear idea of who some of these people are that are in this situation and need your help.
Yeah, we currently, we're serving a lot of single mothers currently, but I would also say that a lot of our families already come to us with a lot of those like boxes checked off. Full-time employment, they've got good cars, and so they've already done some of the easier things that you can accomplish with them. And so a lot of the time, I think what the first question I got asked when I started at Family Promise is like, look, the same question you asked me, and I think the expectation is they're not working and they don't want to try and like all that kind of stuff. And I would say it's 100% the opposite. They've already put in a lot of the work before they got here. And it's a simple thing like a medical bill that sent them spiraling, or another big one is childcare. You know, they either, you know, had childcare and they were working, and then let's say the childcare center got sick, or you know what I mean, and that they had to stay home and take care of their kid, and then they lost their job because they couldn't go to work. And so childcare is a huge issue that our families are facing that have lost, you know, employment opportunities and things like that. Which, you know, you can't pay your rent when you can't go to work. So,
right. Yeah,
a lot of our families, if you have kids under 5 years of age, it takes anywhere between 12 and 18 months to find a childcare because you're on a waiting list that long.
Wow.
Plus, it is some of the studies that we're looking at is it's more expensive to send your child to early child care or to an early child care program versus MSU up at college. So it's more expensive to do that. And so it's pretty hard for families.
So is creating greater availability of affordable childcare something that you get directly involved in, or are there other groups that you partner with who take on that piece of the challenge?
Yeah, so that's actually something we're directly working on because it's been a huge issue of ours for years. And so we are breaking ground January 4th on a new childcare center. It will have 96 children in it from 0 to 5. And so we think, you know, obviously our families are working with, we'll get priority placement, you know, mm-hmm. so they can go in and get jobs. But we are looking at this as almost a preventative method for the community, because if we can add more slots of early childcare, then there'll be more opportunities for kids to get placed so more families can work, which increases the economy.
All right. And what's the mix of funding that's making that possible for you?
You know, we are currently in our quiet phase of the capital campaign. Here I am talking about it on the radio, but we consider it our quiet
phase. Just lower your voice, you're fine.
We call it our quiet phase, but we've been working with our bigger supporters of Family Promise, and then we are going public, obviously, with the groundbreaking starting January 4th.
So, okay, and where is that going to be?
Right behind Lowe's in that big complex of the affordable housing units and CHP and then that. Yeah. So it's going to be exciting. Before COVID, they said that Gallatin County had 30% of the need for childcare that they need here in the Valley for kiddos under 5. And so adding 96 spots will help quite a bit, but it won't solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's unbelievable what COVID has revealed in so many different ways, right? About the way that we live in our community, and we're talking about childcare right now, and mm-hmm. and how important, how would you assess the importance of childcare as having secure access to good childcare, facilitating the overall health of families? How important is it, like, if you could scale it out according, you know, comparing to other factors that are important?
So when we look on that self-sufficiency matrix that I was referring to earlier, it's our number one thing we focus on. And so it's the most important. And, you know, it's not only childcare, but it's also getting the kids in school. So if they haven't been in, you know, high school or any of the elementary schools, so getting them enrolled in there. So because really, we got to get them in that safe spot so that we can work with the families on the other stuff and give them that kind of mental clarity, not having kids running around and all that kind of stuff, that they can focus on the hard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And has this not come out over and over again over the last, what have we been in this COVID mask phase since March?
Yes.
The crucial, the central importance of our children and where they are. I mean, I'm not talking about 3 to 5 year olds. I'm talking about kids in K-12 as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a facet of our life that I don't think it can be overestimated how important it is for parents to have secure access to this kind of care.
Yeah, that has been a huge struggle of ours is, you know, it's so hard. You know, we've actually encouraged families to change jobs in the middle of this pandemic because someone needs to be at home for the online school, right? And so we've been like, okay, Dad, you should probably get a night job or something, you know what I mean? And Mom's going to have a day shift.
Right.
And so we've actually been working with families to change up their standard living situations just to accommodate the, you know, the kids that are having to do online learning. The other thing you think about is quarantining, you know, right? Like my son told me the other day, he's the only, his teacher next door has been quarantined for 6 weeks in a row. And so you think of that classroom, they've been out of school for 6 weeks because of quarantine. And that's, you know, we've experienced with it at the shelter. So these mm-hmm. families that aren't sick but still have to quarantine because they've been in close contact and just throws off everything. And that family that's almost on the verge of crisis anyways, you know what I mean? So throw that in there and it's like, what do? I just got this job and now I got to stay home and panic.
Yeah.
Unnecessary. I'm not unnecessary, but panic. Yeah.
I'm curious, when you referenced online learning, do you have anything in place to help families that you're serving who may not be able to afford their own Wi-Fi, you know, internet access at their own home to be able to facilitate that for kids?
Yeah, so we worked with a few families getting Spectrum because I think Spectrum did some free internet for a while. We also did a call out for computers when it first mm-hmm. hit, and our donor, our you know volunteers and supporters got us some computers for those kiddos. We had to upgrade our internet just even in our shelter because when you think of that many kids, you know, we had, I think our busiest time we had 14 kids on the computers, and so like mm-hmm. that's a lot of bandwidth, and so it's been interesting.
So are you saying that Spectrum actually had a program where they donate some service, or am I?
At the very beginning, they were Spectrum was helping the families if they didn't have internet access, and it was I think a discounted rate or maybe even free, and so we were letting people know about that service, and yeah. But I think providing computers was a huge thing for us with the families because even the school district wasn't expecting this, and they didn't have enough computers for everybody at the very beginning, and so it was kind of all hands on deck. How do we get these computers out to everybody?
Right.
We've touched on some real difficult realities of life that basically present you with your opportunity to provide family promise.
Yeah.
We've talked about low wages. We've talked about the service economy as perhaps being less and less tenable as time goes by, as a way for families to have a life and be secure in the Gallatin Valley. We've talked about land costs and the speculative real estate market as being something that is seems to be out of anyone's control and not going to be in anyone's control anytime soon. We've talked about childcare as a very important piece of the overall wellness of a family, and you've talked about some of the life skills that you try to train families with so that they can take care of themselves and be more responsible to themselves and do better in the future. What about the other piece that we talked about just a little bit, we've touched on just a little bit, and that is the linkages between nonprofit organizations which seem to have similar missions.
Mm-hmm.
Would there be some additional benefit if there could be even greater coordination among nonprofit organizations than there is today? Do you think that might be a way to sort of bolster your success rate? Because you do a fine job, but you are limited because you have finite resources. But
mm-hmm.
what if those resources could expand by having more linkages with other organizations?
Yeah, I would say that's one thing we're pretty proud of, actually, is we've got great partnership with HRDC, and we're coordinating, it's called coordinated entry, and so any families that is experiencing homelessness, they go into a database that we all have access to, and so we kind of know what services they've already been provided and given and all that kind of stuff, and so that's a huge thing, I think, for the community to know that these families, we can kind of see what everybody's doing for them. I think also that HRDC also does a huge thing on housing, and we've been working with them just, you know, because they own houses and rent apartment buildings
mm-hmm.
and all that kind of stuff. And so I'd say we're pretty great on that side of things. But I would say if we could figure out a way to work together just to expand our capacity, because I know everybody's up to the max right now. And I think, yeah, I guess I don't know if I really answered that question, but I really do think that partnerships are always great, and if we can figure out more ways to make stuff happen in the community, let's go for it.
Yeah, well, I was thinking in my mind when I was talking about the Gallatin Valley Interfaith Agency, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think members of that organization also sit on your board, is that right?
Yes, yes.
And is there still the Greater Gallatin Homeless Action Coalition? I can't remember what it was called. Does that still exist?
They do, and my case managers attend that when they have those meetings. They've been doing them on Zoom, you know,
right,
over COVID.
Right, yeah,
but yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So there is already a fair amount of coordination.
There is, and I think that's what's great is there's almost weekly conversation and like saying, hey, I've got this open, or I've got this money. Does anybody else, able to help? We're also, it's kind of cool, the secretaries of all these churches kind of coordinate some communication between all the other agencies, you know, like Salvation Army, HRDC, us, Love Inc., all that. And they'll send out an email, like, I talked to this family and they're experiencing this. Can anybody help? And it's a mass email, and all these agencies work together to figure these family needs out. So that's another great thing that has developed.
Mm-hmm. I was curious, as you know, the cost of living continues to vastly outpace the rate of inflation generally in Bozeman, and we see more and more displacement. you know, in many places that's resulting in more homogenous communities. I was curious, what portion of your clientele are people of color, and what role do you see that support system playing in helping?
Yeah, we actually serve a lot of Native American families. And so I would say, and the reality is really hit with COVID, with the health disparities that they experience. We currently have a family that is scared to death of COVID, and I don't blame her because she's had 9 family members die on the reservation.
Oh my gosh.
And wow. So you hit that home, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so like having us there just even for the support system of that is for her, and to say it's okay, like we're gonna, you know, teach you what we need to do to keep you safe as much as possible. So it's really, you know, I keep talking about COVID has been such a bad thing, but it's really hit home some really important things that we need to remember. And that's one of them, you know, that we hear about all the time is the health disparities in our Native population. And here we are seeing it really firsthand.
Any thoughts on kind of the bigger picture nationally on how to counter what I'd call a dominant paradigm of people should be self-sufficient, rugged individualism, compared to most other developed nations where there's far more of a sense of shared responsibility rather than just letting people fall into homelessness and other misfortune if things don't go their way?
Oh, that's a good question.
You know, that's kind of putting you on the spot for a much bigger picture than the local work, but, you know, it's one of the things we try to hit on some of the bigger picture issues on The View from Here, and would love any thoughts you have on that topic if you'd like to share them.
Yeah, I think this hit home for me, I guess, too. I've had a lot of life lessons this year, but I was sitting in a meeting with all the other executive directors of other nonprofits here in town. We meet twice a month. And someone brought to my attention that you're part of the problem when you're silent. And I was like, taken aback by that comment. And I guess because I think that just really hit home, because I've never, you know, have really had a conversation of people of color or, you know, discrimination or all that kind of stuff. And because it just has never hit me that anybody's different, right? I just kind of live my life. And when she said that to me, I was like, oh, you're kind of right. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we kind of have that mentality more amongst all of us, that being silent is part of the problem, I think you'd see some more of that connection and people working together to solve these issues.
Well, could you just maybe say a touch more about what? Was there
Oh, I'm sorry. There was some back there.
Word in the blank there.
You guys were there, right? I'm sorry. I can't read between the lines. We were talking about when BLM started the protests and things like that. And this is a racial social justice project here in town. Mm-hmm. And she was just talking about what was going on and how they were going to do the peaceful protest and that kind of stuff. And she really said, you know, when you're silent, you're part of the problem. And I that was kind of where that conversation came. But you can take it out on all levels, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just about racial coloring and discrimination and all that kind of stuff. It is about homeless populations, and it's about child abuse, and it's about whatever. And if we really want to make a change here, we can't be silent. We need to talk about it more and more. And, you know, not be scared of it. I think sometimes you're scared of it.
Yeah. So let's say, you know, I'm having a conversation with a friend of mine, and they say something disparaging about people who are homeless, calling them bums, or, well, they should have done this or that, or their own fault. What kind of response might you suggest that's going to not put people on the defensive, but help steer them in the direction of maybe opening their mind a little?
I actually would invite them to spend a night at our shelter. I would say, you know, I don't think I could convince someone, really, you know, no matter what I say, I don't think I could convince you, but I think if I could get them to see it firsthand. And so I'd invite them to spend one dinner in our shelter with these families, and I think their mind would be changed really quick.
What would happen to change their minds?
They would see 3 or 4 families sitting around a giant table in the dining room. People of all different colors, different ages, grandparents raising children, you know, their grandkids, all sitting together, talking about their day and brainstorming how to make their lives better and supporting each other and talking about everyday struggles that they're experiencing. And hearing kids laughing in the background, or maybe it is even a baby crying, but one meal with our families, you understand that they're all there to make a difference, because it's not easy. And so if I can get those people to come in and sit at that table, I think one night their minds will be changed.
Mm-hmm. Good answer.
Thank you.
Indeed. Well, we're down to just a few minutes here. Is there anything that we haven't touched on about Family Promise, Crystal, that you think is important for folks in the community to have an idea of?
You know, I don't. I would just say that it's, once again, it's not a one-size-fits-all for everybody, and it takes more than just Family Promise, and we just all need to band together to support these families so they have the opportunity just like anybody else does here in Bozeman.
Most assuredly, and as I'm listening to you, I keep thinking about another part of the puzzle, which is not a part of your objective, not a part of your mission, but I think drives what you do, and that is lack of living wages, the incredible spiraling cost of real estate in our community, and the market, which is driving costs up, and rewards are not keeping up with the inflation, particularly when it comes to housing. And I applaud your work. I think your work is amazing. It's beautiful, and it's inspirational. And I also hope that at some point we could become inspired to think about, and this is not a request of you, this is just me, I guess, editorializing, yeah. But my notion is that we can't service and love and help and assist our way out of this situation that we're in. It's going to take macroeconomic changes that only can be enacted by county commissions, city commissions, and state legislatures, in a sense, right? What you're doing is heroic work. What you're doing is amazing and absolutely essential. And I think also important work could be done on those policy levels. And, you know, how can you control the rapid inflation in land costs? How can you do that? Well, yeah, I believe that it can be done. And I hope that there's going to be a group out there, or there will be advocacy out there to assist you. You don't need to do this. I'm just saying this to anybody on KGBM 95.9 Gallon Valley Community Radio who might be interested in advocating at the county level or even at the state level for policies that might make the work of Family Promise easier and one day maybe not even a necessity.
Earlier we talked about local policy, but is there anything at the Montana state level, programs that either support your work or policy changes that you think would make a difference in tackling the problems of homelessness in Montana?
Yeah, so one of the big things Family Promise National is working on, and sometimes they like email us and say, hey, this is going up, you know, give a quick call, is actually the eviction issue that we have. And it's working on maybe, you know, what can we do to not evict individuals that have families? Because you know what I mean? Like, when you evict a family, that child doesn't have a choice. And so looking at that and trying to figure out how we can put some safety nets around that so children always have a warm roof over their head. And so I know that's been a big push, and we were excited to get that during COVID, and we know it ends in January, but if we could somehow extend that a little bit further, that would be amazing. So mm-hmm. Yeah.
And are there many municipalities or states that have their own specific protections that that go an extra step to try to prevent people from being displaced from their homes? And is there any model that could be followed in that regard?
No, I think our ultimate thing would be it's a federal thing or at a national level, mm-hmm. and it's kind of across the state. So you know what I mean? The same mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so that's what we kind of wish for, and that's what we're pushing for on a national level.
Very good. Why don't you just give listeners your website and any, if you have a primary social media channel to follow, and any final thoughts on how people can best connect with you?
Yeah, definitely. So our website is familypromisegv.org. You can give us a call at 406-582-7388. Or, you know, we are active on Facebook, so just look up Family Promise of Gallatin Valley on Facebook and you can find us there as well.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us,
Crystal.
Today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming in and speaking with us on this wintry day. And thank you for your incredible work in our community. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.
You've been listening to The View from Here on KGBM 95.9 FM. Our guest today has been Crystal Chvilacek of Family Promise. And you can also listen to the program online at kgvm.org. We'll see you next time on The View from Here.